Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Every day, the headlines have come in for years now. Yesterday, seven more U.S. soldiers dead in Iraq. Today, fear of famine in Afghanistan, casualty tolls, threats, and bombings. Endless. New York Times correspondent Dexter Filkins knows. He's been on the front behind the lines since before 9/11. Now he's emptied his notebooks, all that sand and sweat and blood and ambiguity, to tell the unspoken truths of the war on terror, what it is, what it means, how it's felt on the ground. His new book, The Forever War, is being hailed as this war's classic. This hour, On Point, Dexter Filkins and The Forever War. You can join the conversation. Have you been waiting for the deeper story, the ground truth? What's your question for the reporter who may have brought it? Joining me now from Irvine, California's Dexter Filkins. He's correspondent for the New York Times. His work in Iraq and Afghanistan, which he has covered for a decade, has brought him top awards, including a George Polk Award for reporting on the Battle of Fallujah in 2004. His book, The Forever War, is just out this week. Novelist Robert Stone, in his review, puts it in the tradition of Paul Fussell and Michael Hare's Vietnam classic, Dispatches. It's high praise. Dexter Filkins, thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, thank you very much.
AC/DC and Hell's Bells behind us there at the open. You open the book with it, a moment of really harrowing telling of a handful of hours in the life of that Marine push on Fallujah. And I would be grateful if you would just begin reading straight out there just to get a sense of that. There you were, Fallujah, November 2004. Really in a kind of living and dying hell. Could you just open with a reading for us, Dexter?
Sure. The Marines were pressed flat on a rooftop when the dialogue began to unfold. It was 2 a.m. The minarets were flashing by the light of airstrikes, and rockets were sailing on trails of sparks. First came the voices from the mosques, rising above the thundery guns. "The Americans are here," howled a voice from a loudspeaker in a minaret. "The holy war, the holy war. Get up and fight for the city of mosques." Bullets poured without direction and without end. No one lifted his head. "This is crazy," one of the Marines yelled to his buddy over the noise. "Yeah," the buddy yelled back, "and we've only taken one house." And then, as if from the depths, came a new sound, violent, menacing, and dire. I looked back over my shoulder to where we had come from, into the vacant field at Fallujah's northern edge. A group of Marines were standing at the foot of a gigantic loudspeaker, the kind used at rock concerts. It was AC/DC, the Australian heavy metal band, pouring out its unbridled sounds. I recognized the song immediately. Hell's Bells, the band's celebration of satanic power, had come to us on the battlefield. Behind the strains of its guitars, a church bell tolled 13 times. "I'm a rolling thunder, a pouring rain. I'm coming on like a hurricane. My lightning's flashing across the sky. You're only young, but you're gonna die." The Marines raised the volume on the speakers, and the sound of gunfire began to recede. Airstrikes were pulverizing the houses in front of us. In a flash, a building vanished. The voices from the mosques were hysterical in their fury, and they echoed along the city's northern rim. "Allahu Akbar," cried one of the men in the mosques. "God is great. There is nothing so glorious as to die for God's path, your faith, and your country." "I won't take no prisoners, won't spare no lives. Nobody's putting up a fight. I got my bell. I'm going to take you to hell. I'm going to get you. Satan, get you. God is great." The shouting continued until the houses in front of us were obliterated, and the firing and the music began to die.
Dexter Filkins reading from his new book, which is getting praise all over the place, The Forever War. And that is just the beginning of his prologue report on an absolutely bewildering, bullet-packed advance into Fallujah, 12 hours that just goes a couple of blocks, death all around in a kind of surreal confusion with AC/DC, the heavy metal band. They're up against the loudspeakers of the mosques in Fallujah. It is a harrowing telling. Even if you've read everything, and I have read an awful lot of you, Dexter, over these years,
you
opened those notebooks and turned it back to us in a new way here. I remember not long after you came back, I mean, there's a better part of a decade really unfolded in this story. It goes back to before 9/11. You were with the LA Times first, based in India, into Afghanistan, and then, of course, there's 9/11 and Iraq, the invasion, Afghanistan, the invasion of war. What did you set out to do? We had dinner not long after you got back. I listened to you begin to try and tell the stories, and there was so much. I sort of despaired that you'd ever be able to really pour it out. You've done it. What was your battle plan for getting this out in a new way, in a fresh way, taking us deeper?
Well, there was a lot in there. I think when we had dinner, I think that was last year, but it was all kind of jammed up in there at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt like there's been a lot of great books about Iraq and Afghanistan, but I felt that most of them had been written from kind of 10,000 feet up, you know, a big wide view, which is absolutely necessary, but a big wide view, what happened in Washington, why, how. And I thought what I could offer, because I've seen so many things on the ground, was a kind of a more visceral sense of what it's like. What does it feel like? You know, what's it feel like when you're lying on a rooftop and under gunfire and, you know, they're playing AC/DC in the background at 2 o'clock in the morning? That's what I felt like I could do, because I've seen so much. And so I wanted to get the desert and the sand and the blood and the sweat and the fear and the elation and the ambiguity. So that I tried to sort of boil it all down to its essence.
When you read the daily stories, and you produced an awful lot of them yourself, and your colleagues in Iraq or in Afghanistan who have sacrificed a lot to keep the news coming, even though the nation's eye has kind of turned away recently, especially in a week like this one. But day after day when you read those, and they're still pressing headlines. I mean, 7 American troops dead just yesterday or the day before in Iraq. What's the thing that you have felt missing, the sort of deeper music of these individual conflicts, of this bigger period of conflict? What was the vacuum you were feeling in the news reports?
Well, you know, we try when you work for a daily newspaper. I mean, first of all, you never have any time. You know, you're kind of, you know, there's a saying in the newspaper business, you're walking away from some event and you say, you know, to your colleague, you know, one of these days I'm going to write about something after it happens. You're just running and gunning all the time. And there isn't a lot of time to sort of sit back and really think about what you've seen. And so I wanted to kind of strip away the you know, dates, times, even events, you know, and to try to get down to its essence, to what it's like. And that's hard, you know. I mean, I had 600 notebooks when I got back from all those years abroad. And, you know, I threw most of them out. I mean, I went through them and went through them and went through them. I think I ended up writing 500 pages. I cut 200 pages from it. I just wanted to get the essential stuff.
Your book is being compared, and this is high praise indeed, to Michael Hare's Dispatches Out of the Vietnam Era.
Yeah, that's a great book.
Absolutely fantastic. 1977, it kind of fixed a lot of the poetry of Vietnam in a lot of people's minds. I mean, there were many other pieces to that fixing of poetry, but his images of deceit and grunts and jungle and drugs and Jimi Hendrix, it's kind of the way we think of Vietnam now.
Yes.
But do these wars stick in the same way? Was there something about that, you know, that Southeast Asian environment that made it sort of more accessible to the romantic or bleak imagination of Americans? I'm not sure how you would describe it. Is the jungle, the desert, the arid mountains of Afghanistan, is this environment just a tougher one to make stick in the American mind, to push in deep?
Well, it's you know, they're different wars. They're very different wars, and as you say, one is jungles and drugs and, you know, Jimi Hendrix and the Viet Cong and the other is, as you say, arid. It's desert. It's hot. It's monochromatic. it's really, really difficult. And it's really, really kind of serious in a way, I think, that I mean, at least in the memory of Vietnam and the legacy of Vietnam is this kind of drug haze, you know, and maybe that's from the movies and mm-hmm. from books like Dispatches. And this one just is, I think it's tougher than that. It's more arid than that, as you say. But I think it's still, you know, it does have these wars have their own particular character. They're different. So they needed to be written about differently.
Do you think Americans have a real visceral mental image yet, even now after all these years of these wars, in their minds? I mean, maybe it will come and stick in part from a book like this one. But, you know, you must have had a million conversations with Americans back here. Do they seem to have the sort of visceral reference points to these wars that we've been in the midst of for so long now?
Well, that's a little difficult for me to say because, of course, I've been over there and not here. But I think, you know, everybody's got, you know, probably the TV image of their mind of the aftermath of a car bombing. But, you know, it's also much more than that. But I think the short answer is no. And part of that is because, by and large, it's an incredibly difficult conflict, particularly Iraq, to report. I mean, I think we're well over 150 reporters have been killed in Iraq. You know, we're targets, too, in a way that really reporters have never been. And the result of that is that, you know, there aren't that many reporters over there anymore because it's too expensive and it's too dangerous. And the ones who are have to move about very, very carefully.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a deeper view of the war, the wars we're in right now, their culture, their unspoken truths, their mysteries, with New York Times correspondent Dexter Filkins, who covered Iraq, covered Afghanistan, has now emptied his notebooks into a riveting new book being hailed as the literary telling of the War on Terror years. It's called The Forever War. Dexter Filkins joins us from Irvine, California, and it is powerful stuff, notebooks taken out and retold in a way that can really take you right there. Dexter, I wish you'd take us a little further into that Marine advance on Fallujah that you were part of. We heard Hell's Bells from AC/DC cranked up loud at the start of it. There you are on the street. I mean, and the amount of munitions sort of pouring in every direction, the chaos. We should read just another stretch of that prologue for us. Take us further on the trail you were on with those Marines that day, 2004.
For 7 months, Fallujah had been controlled by jihadis who held the city in a medieval thrall. And now the Marines were taking it back, 6,000 of them, going into the city on foot in the middle of a November night. I was traveling with a company of 150 Marines called Bravo of the 1st Battalion, 8th Regiment. Ashley Gilbertson, an Australian photographer, was with me. We stepped into the blackened streets and Bravo split into three columns, one for each platoon. We moved half a block before the mortar fire began. Big mortars, 82 millimeters, exploding in the next street over. Everyone froze but Reed Omohundro, a stocky Texan and Bravo Company's commander. Omohundro was 34, which was old for a Marine captain. He'd enlisted out of high school, went to Texas A&M on a scholarship, and became an officer later than most. But he was a better captain for it. Omohundro advanced in the darkness, as if guided by some inner sonar, sensing the location of his men, confident he knew where the shells would fall. "This way," Omohundro said, and we crept for another block in the darkness until he stopped and put up his hand. Gunfire rang out, and we scrambled for the walls on the sides of the street. The insurgents knew what they were doing. They were bracketing us with their shells, dropping them to the left and to the right. They were falling close now, exploding in titanic crashes, more closely each time. I'd seen mortars in the movies and even in Iraq, but never this close and never so big. Their booms were crushing, and I imagined the shards of metal flying away from each shell. I felt sure we were going to die if we didn't move, and I felt sure we would die if we did. We tried to back up, to retrace our steps, but there were snipers behind us, too. With the mortars crashing closer, Omohundro and his radio man, Sergeant Kenneth Hudson, were the only ones still in the middle of the street. Hudson looked terribly young. Some of the Marines were grimacing, preparing to be hit. Four men stepped from the darkness. They were not part of Bravo Company. I hadn't seen them before. They wore flight suits that shimmered in the night, and tennis shoes and hoods that made them look like executioners. The four men wore goggles that shrouded their eyes and gave off lime-green penumbras that lightened their faces. With the shells exploding, I got off the wall and rejoined the captain in the street, shaking in the knees, and I listened to him tell the executioners the location of the snipers. "Up ahead," he said. One of the four men mumbled something, but I couldn't hear. I couldn't see their eyes through the green glowing, but one of them was on the balls of his feet, bouncing like a football player on the sidelines. "Coach," he seemed to be saying, "put me in the game." The four men peeled off into the blackness without a sound. Moments passed, and the shelling stopped, and then the sniper fire stopped. We never saw the men again. Omohundro got off his knee and looked at his men who were hugging the walls. "Get moving," he said. The pace quickened, a movie reel in the dark. Sailing in from above came a white flare that shattered as it descended into our ranks. Someone yelled, "Phosphorus," and one of the Marines screamed and grabbed me and threw me into a mulberry bush. I was angry at him for that, running me over. Then another Marine yanked off my pack and pointed to the fist-sized chunks burning through my sleeping bag. "All the way to your bones," he shouted. I threw the pack on my back and ran to catch the Marines, leaving behind me a trail of white feathers. A moment of quiet gave way to dawn. We broke into a trot, our boots thudding on the pavement like hooves, rounding a corner, to the right, to the left, up Tharthar Street, when a jeep, a blue Cherokee, entered our flowing ranks. The door swung open. I was still running and wrenching my head to see when a bunch of men piled out with guns and rocket-propelled grenades. Suddenly I saw them, black eyes, pale skin, and baggy gray suits with ammo belts. I thought they had us. They thought they had us when the Marines on the roof opened fire. I had no idea how the Marines had gotten up there or when. I thought we were dead. The head of one of the jihadis burst like a tomato, the deep red of his brainy blood splattering against his clammy skin and his head disappearing. The jihadi fell back onto the street and spread his arms wide like a headless Christ. Three more jihadis died right there on Tharthar Street, and two of them scampered away. A couple of the kids ran them down and shot them, and one of the wounded jihadis rolled over on the ground and pulled something on his jacket and exploded.
Dexter Filkins, reading from his new book, The Forever War. There's the Battle of Fallujah, Marines advancing, and jihadis, Iraqis, fighting, and Dexter right in the middle of it. I want to open the lines to callers. Bill in Norfolk, Virginia, you're on the air with Dexter.
Yes. I just wanted to talk about a situation that I had back in 1971 in Vietnam. I was on radio watch, and I was in the command bunker, and most of the time it was pretty boring, and we would show movies. Well, this particular evening we were watching Woodstock. And right in the middle of one of Santana's songs, Soul Sacrifice, we had a contact, and I was unable to turn off the movie. But here I was in the middle of a war zone watching a peace movie, calling it an airstrike, and watching Woodstock. I just, you know, the bizarreness and of the whole situation just kind of reminds me of some of the things that that go on in a war.
Bill, thanks for bringing that back. I mean, that's the kind of archetypal moment from Vietnam. And Dexter, I hear you laughing in the way that only a war correspondent, I guess, earns the right to laugh. But what about the U.S. troops there now and the cultural context they bring to the war? What's on the video screen, you know, when the car bomb goes off outside? We know how American troops tended to look at the Vietnamese enemy. The Vietnamese around them, what about how American troops today look at Iraqis, for that matter, Afghanis?
I think, you know, it's changed a lot in the 5.5 years. I mean, I just think back of 2003, 2004, when things started to go pretty seriously wrong. You know, the American response, which they're happy to concede at the time, was pretty heavy-handed. You know, go in, kill and capture, grab all the Iraqi males between the ages of, you know, 18 and 35, take them away, question them. And it was kind of this broad brush. Let's get the ragheads, you know, let's get them before they get us. And so there was a lot of anger there. I mean, I it's hard for me to repeat some of that. There's a lot in the book without going into some serious profanity. But And that's changed. And it's as the sort of strategy of the war has changed, you can actually see the attitude of people change as well, of the soldiers. And so now, you know, whereas before the main goal was basically to kill and capture as many people as you can, now the goal is to sort of protect the Iraqi population and to separate them from the insurgents. And so they still kill the bad guys. You know, it's just they have a much better sense of who the bad guys are now, and a much better sense of who their friends are. So it's much more nuanced than it used to be.
And what about the American soldiers themselves? The population that's there, the cultural context that they bring, the cultural artifacts, what I don't know, music, you name it, that they lean on and sort of hear when they go out to war. Is it all this kind of AC/DC backdrop, or?
I'll tell you, there's one moment that I remember really well. They don't, unfortunately, you know, they don't get to, when a bunch of Marines go on a street patrol, you know, in Baghdad, no Walkmans allowed, mm-hmm. or anything like that. One moment that I remember very well was I was in Ramadi not that long ago, 2006. Mm. The place was just, this was before the awakening changed everything. And the city was just decimated. And there were just, God, there were IEDs, homemade bombs everywhere, you know, five or six on every street. Mm. And we pulled into an intersection. I was in the back of a Humvee with a bunch of guys. I think the oldest guy was 21. And we thought we were going to get hit. I mean, all the Iraqis started leaving the street. And that's always a bad sign. When you're mm-hmm. driving around and you see the Iraqis start taking off, it's like they know. And the guy in front of me, who was like the great-great-grandnephew of General Patton, said to me, "We're going to get hit. We're going to get hit." Mm. And I was so sure that we were going to get hit, and I didn't really know what to do. So I picked up a copy of Surfing magazine that the Marines had been passing around in the Humvee, and I started flipping through the Surfing magazine, and I started reading about surfing in Costa Rica. We didn't get hit, as it turned out.
A lucky day in a surfing interlude.
Great waves,
and a little mental vacation from some incredibly harrowing spots. Let's take a call from Marblehead, Massachusetts, and Leslie. You're on the air, Leslie.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Dex. Dex, congratulations. A long climb from Mount Rainier.
Thank you.
I just wanted to know how much you have, or how this has really affected you psychologically speaking, in terms of, you know, since your return, and how it impacts you in terms of your, you know, as an American and your choice in the upcoming election.
Well, it's really, really hard to come back. I came back in late 2006. I went back in 07 briefly, and I just got back from then last Friday. But mm-hmm. It's very, very hard to come back. You know, I was there for almost 4 years. Every decision you make is kind of fraught with, you know, life and death. People are dying. You know, this epic history is unfolding in front of you. You know, the tectonic plates are really pushing up against one another. And you can see all this, and it's unbelievably dramatic and exhilarating. I mean, I'd be lying if I said otherwise. And then you come back, and in my case, I went from Baghdad to Cambridge, Massachusetts, you know, which I think must be one of the quietest cities on earth. And boy, you know, that was jarring. Really, it was like a whiplash. I mean, suddenly I was, you know, the most consequential thing I did all day was, you know, decide what kind of sandwich I was going to get at the deli, you know, and it's hard. It's really, really hard. You have to just kind of downshift very, very rapidly.
A lot of American soldiers have trouble with that. It must give you a special empathy for that difficulty. I mean, you're not the one pulling the trigger, but in a lot of these stories, you're next to the ones pulling the trigger.
Yeah, you know, I'll tell you one quick story, and it's true. I mean, I stay in touch with a lot of these guys and a lot of the reporters, of course, just, I mean, if only because it's a kind of shared experience that very few people have had. But there was a Marine who I'd gotten to know on the rooftop of a building in Ramadi. He was like 19 years old. He was from Georgia. And I called his mother not terribly long ago. And I wanted to get in touch with him. And I said, you know, where's your son? And she said, well, he's on a ship. But she told me about when he came home. And she said for 6 weeks, you know, here's a Marine, a guy on a roof who was killing people. Tough guy. For 6 weeks when he got home, he slept in bed with me because he was so tormented.
With his mom.
With his mom. Mm-hmm. And she said, you know, I felt so bad about it. I had to hold him, and he would kind of ride through these terrible dreams and sweat and moan and turn.
Good mother.
There you go.
Let's take a call from Buffalo, New York. Lou, you're on the air with Dexter Filkins.
Yeah, Tom, thank you very much for taking my call. I guess I just wanted to, with his intense experiences now with the Marines through Fallujah and Ramadi, my son was a part of deployment in Ramadi in 2006 with the 1-6, what the Marines call 1-6 Bravo Company. And I was wondering if he had shared any embedded experiences with that group of Marines.
I'm trying to think. Ramadi 06, what was going on then, Lou? Was that when it was tough in Ramadi?
Well, they were there with the trying to keep the insurgency under control, kind of thing. I think they were also involved in starting to, this interaction with the youth groups in Ramadi to try to win hearts and minds.
Right, to bring the Sunnis over. Dexter, how about it? Do you have a mental map of all the units? Marines 1-6 Bravo?
Yeah, I think I know the 1-6 guys. I think if you can sort of mentally picture Ramadi in 2006, it looked like the end of the world. It looked like Dresden in 1945. It was completely obliterated. There was one. I mean, really, this is a city that had been fought over and fought over and fought over, and it was completely decimated. There was one building that stood in the middle of the town. It was called the Government Center, which everybody used to joke about because there was no government and there was no center. And it was held by 50 Marines. I think these are the guys in the 1-6. They were rotating it in and out of there. Just mind-boggling. You know, it was like a science fiction movie, like a French Foreign Legion post. You know, we came under attack. I was there for 2 weeks. We came under attack every single day. It was 125 degrees. There was no electricity. There were no bathrooms. You know, there were these things called wag bags, and you had to go to the bathroom in a bag and set it on fire and throw it outside. I mean, it was really, you know, it was like sort of a combination of Mad Max and Blade Runner.
When you think of Iraq now, those bad times, when you think of Afghanistan, does it bring, for the American soldiers' experience, and we'll talk more about the Iraqi and Afghani experience, but for the American soldiers, is it like a completely different universe? Do they blend together in your mind, Dexter? You spent so much time in each. Do you shift frames dramatically when you go from contemplating the one to the other?
Well, in terms of the American soldiers, no. I mean, they're really, really different places. I mean, it's easy to kind of, you know, it's easy for it all to blur from a distance. But for me, they were such completely different experiences. You know, Afghanistan is this mountainous, unbelievably beautiful place. Mm-hmm. And my experience there, I was there in 2001, 2002 for the initial invasion. It was an incredibly happy one. You know, it was really a joyous time. I mean, there weren't a lot of American soldiers on the ground, very few. They were up in the air dropping bombs. But, you know, the Taliban collapsed and it was like a party, you know. I mean, we'd roll into these towns and, you know, the guys would be, you know, shaving their beards off and the women would be pulling their burqas off and they'd be digging up television sets out of the ground that they'd buried 2 years before in plastic bags. It was incredible. Iraq was never like that, you know? Iraq was really, really hard from, like, the first day we went in, you know, first day, very first day.
There you go again.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a deeper view of the war, the wars this country is in, their culture, their unspoken truths, their mysteries. Dexter Filkin covered Afghanistan from long before 9/11, Afghanistan and Iraq for the better part of the last decade. He's out with a new book that is getting the very highest kind of rave reviews. It's called The Forever War. He joins us from a studio in Irvine, California. He's emptied his notebooks to bring us the kind of deeper music of these wars, to raise through well, the pictures and the visceral experience of the war from the soldier side, from the civilian side, what is really going on here and how it imprints back on us. Dexter, Robert Stone, great novelist, reviewed the book in the Times last weekend, and he referenced back to historians like Paul Fussell, Madras Ecksteins, and talking about how they've demonstrated, quoting him here, how engagement in an ongoing military struggle affects the collective consciousness and self-regard of a nation, creating a transactional process between the front lines and the civilian street. I was reading last night, and it's such an absorbing book you put forward here, but I was still trying to feel that back and forth. I mean, I saw and lived through how Vietnam did that. Paul Fussell, of course, with the great World War I did that. Do you feel this war bleeding now back and forth? Do you feel a two-way kind of conversation, interaction, cultural bleed between the battlefront and the country at home where you've been, as you wrote, as you look back on your experience there?
I actually don't. I think,
isn't that weird?
Yeah, it's really weird. I mean, I think that's one of the essential weirdnesses of these wars. You know, the wars you mentioned, World War I, World War II, you know, these were gigantic national endeavors. You know, we had general conscription, you know, millions of people went off to fight, you know, war bonds, you know, shortages at home, you know, factories taken, all of that. And there's none of that here. There's nothing at all. It's a volunteer army. Most of the grunts are from small towns across the United States. And I think for that reason, you know, taxes obviously haven't gone up. There's no shortage of anything. For that reason, the war doesn't resonate in the same way. And so, you know, I could go, in fact, I did, when I was in the Battle of Fallujah, which I was just reading from here, you know, I flew to New York. I was in Manhattan in a restaurant, you know, a week later. And I remember when I came out, I went through a metal detector, I set off some detector at an airport. Yeah. I had so much bomb residue on me that I set the thing off, and they thought I was a terrorist. But I was sitting in a restaurant in Manhattan, and I was listening to two people talk about the war, and some kid was saying, well, I don't have to. My father asked me to support the troops, so I don't have to do that, you know. And I wanted to push the guy's head through the window because he didn't have to care, you know. And so I think in that sense, you know, nobody was going to make this guy fight, you know. He probably went to a good school and had a good job. So I think in that way, the conversation is kind of muted.
Very muted. Very muted compared to what we read right here. Let's go to Hartford, Connecticut, and Kyle. Kyle, you're on the air with Dexter Filkins.
Hi, Tom. I was in the Army, did two tours in Iraq, 04 to 05 and then 06 to 08. And I definitely saw a change in the sentiment of the soldiers, particularly from the first tour to the second tour, and even during the second tour as the awakening took hold, we were at in the area of Taji, and we were operating up in Tarmia as well. But as the attitude changed towards the Iraqis amongst the soldiers, there's still, I believe, an underlying frustration and to a degree anger at the fact that the Iraqis are not taking more control and more responsibility for their country and themselves, that they lacked the skills and the organizational structures they needed to take control and take charge themselves. And I was curious if the author saw, despite a change in the attitudes, that sentiment that there was still underlying frustrations and perhaps anger that the Iraqis are making progress, but not enough, not fast enough. They should be able to do this.
Kyle, thanks. Dexter?
Well, I mean, I think he's just sort of hit at the $64,000 question, which is we've set this thing up. It's taken us 5.5 years and $1 trillion and more than 4,000 of our soldiers dead. But we finally have brought some stability to the place. And now the question is, so what happens when we leave? Has this thing that we've constructed, and, you know, it's pretty tenuous and it's pretty fragile, but at the moment, it's, you know, I mean, I just came from there. It's remarkable, the improvements, I mean, and the awakening and all, and the surge and all that. Was it going to work when we walk away? You know, boy, I think if you, all you got to do is walk around. And I think the answer is, you know, if the American troops disappeared, you know, tomorrow, it would not work. It would fall apart in a minute. So I think to answer your question, no, I don't think they're there yet. And that's been the sort of a central problem from the start of this war. You know, this was a broken country when we got there. you know, and it's never been much of a nation. You know, it's not even 100 years old, and there isn't that sense of nationhood. And it was shattered and broken and traumatized by this terrible dictatorship. And when we got there and broke the government and broke the regime, it all fell apart in our hands. And we spent the last 5.5 years trying to put it back together.
But the soldiers keep fighting in spite of that, and fighting and sacrificing fiercely. I mean, that seems like it's a lot to ask. Bing West read your book for the Washington Post, a former Marine from Vietnam. And you know, as he describes, he says, in many of these stories, you're describing or depicting loss and grief uncompensated by accomplishment.
Well, that's the way it was. I mean, I was there for, you know, it wasn't the purpose of my book to sort of gauge the progress of this war. It was, you know, more to tell a kind of visceral, emotional tale. But look, I left it in late 2006. It was absolutely the nadir. I mean, the country was in something pretty close to anarchy at that point. And I think as somebody like me, who's just an observer, I'm not part of the military, sometimes, particularly in the really, really bad years, 2005, 2006, I had this kind of overwhelming, tragic sense watching the military. Because, you know, they're different from you and me. They don't quit. They don't have an off switch, you know, and they don't have the words defeat or loss in their DNA. And so they just keep going. And so on one hand, it was like they'd been handed this job that was probably impossible. And not given enough resource to do it, and they were going to work themselves to death to get it right, and that's what I saw a lot of.
Dexter, the last bit you read from the prologue, again in the Battle of Fallujah here, the Iraqi jihadis had just stepped out. There was fire back. We should read just to the end of this amazing sequence of hours when the Marines were under so much fire, and the Iraqis fighting fiercely in return. They step up to that blue Cherokee that they've just sprayed with bullets. Take us on home from there.
Okay. The kids started slapping plastic explosives onto the Cherokee, taking out big cakes of it and throwing it on. And one of them yelled, "It's going to blow," and somebody yelled, "Fire in the hole," and we got behind a wall, and the earth shook, and the Jeep disappeared. An axle remained in the road, and a piece of engine block, and some smoke. The jihadis were gone, like the moment never happened. We gathered in an enclosed area behind a brick wall, spilling into it the clop-clop of boots and clangs of metal and heavy breathing. There were 40 of us, Bravo Company's first platoon, and Ashley and me. More 19-year-olds went up to the roof with their giant guns. A road lay in front of us, a 6-lane boulevard, one of Fallujah's main drags called 40th Street. Just then, the insurgents spotted us, and they opened up from both ends of the road. Bullets flew up the boulevard and down, thousands of bullets, multitudes of them, crisscrossing in front of us. The Marines opened fire at once, screaming and shooting, everybody's guns on full auto, shouting and shooting, all the testosterone of 40 young men. They clamored for space along the top of the wall where they could fire, standing on oil drums and old washing machines. I stood against the bricks, the boots of the kids level with my head, and felt strangely safe. Almost serene against the roar of the guns, the one safe place, bullet casings tumbled over my shoulders. Captain Almohundro was on his knee, and Hudson was handing him the radio. Almohundro yelled something, and in a few minutes the American artillery started coming in. One shot after another landed on the buildings from which the gunfire was coming, one of them the Mohammedia Mosque. The artillery fire was too accurate to believe. American guys a mile back were dropping 155-millimeter shells right through the ceilings, one after the other, each one coming in with the whistle of a train. It was a clear day, and from my spot on the wall, I followed the shells with my eyes, the streaking black lines, all the way in. Without warning, Almohundro yelled, "Go!" and pointed into the street, and all the kids started running. Just like that, no discussion, with the firing carrying on in its horrendous way. It seemed lunatic, but everyone tore out from behind the brick wall and into the street, and I tore out after them. Ashley was out in front of me, moving like a greyhound. I took 10 strides and felt the bullets whiz past and bounce off the pavement, and I knew I was going to die, so I stopped cold, knowing immediately I'd done a stupid thing, running and stopping both. I turned and dashed back behind the wall. For a moment, I felt like a coward behind that wall, and then I remembered. It wasn't my war, not my army. I'm just a goddamn reporter. I'll wait out the war here. Come back and get me when it's over. A handful of Marines who had stayed behind to cover the crossing of the others were climbing down, the last Marines, and with the gunfire still roaring down the boulevard, they ran, and I forgot my thoughts and took off after them. The wind from the bullets brushed my neck. Marines were writhing in the street, tangles of blood and legs, while other Marines were stooping and helping them and also getting shot. I kept running, pumping, flying toward the other side as fast as I could with my 70 pounds of gear when I saw a pair of Marines standing in a doorway and waving to me to come on, come on. I ran straight for them, and I could see by the looks on their faces they weren't sure if I was going to make it. They were holding their arms out like they wanted to save me, and I reached them, and they grabbed me and my pack and threw me through the door. I lay on the floor for a minute as I regained my senses and thought I was nothing so much now as a child in his crib in the care of his parents, they 19 and me 43. I found Ash lying against a wall. He nodded that he was okay. Then I found Almahundro, who had planted himself on the second floor, steady as a brick. He was standing next to a window, scanning the scene, and he raised his hand over his shoulder and asked for the radio. Snapped his fingers. "Hudson, radio," Almahundro said. "Hudson, give me the radio," he said again. He turned around. "He's been shot, sir." Hudson was one of five guys hit crossing 40th Street. He lived. Sergeant Lonnie Wells, of Vandegrift, Pennsylvania, bled to death on the spot, right in front of us, his worried eyes looking upward as his life ebbed away. The shooting began to fade. I looked out the window with Almahundro. We were standing across the street from the Mohammedia Mosque, badly damaged and smoking, but still resplendent with its shot-up green dome. A squad of bedraggled Marines were circling the mosque, moving around and peering into the windows but not venturing inside. At that moment, an amazing sight appeared. Men in clean uniforms, as if transported from another world. Iraqi men, a long row of them, holding their guns with worried looks and stepping towards the mosque. The Iraqi army. One of the Marines, stooped and filthy, swung open the mosque's front door. The Iraqi army marched inside. It was 2 p.m., 12 hours since we'd climbed out of the troop carriers and walked into the city. We'd advanced about 200 yards. Almahundro ordered some of his men on the roof to stand watch. We put our backs against the wall, slid to the floor, and fell asleep.
Dexter Filkins reading from his new book, The Forever War. You can read a fuller excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Jeff in Cambridge, Massachusetts, you're on the air with Dexter Filkins.
Thanks very much, Tom. Mm-hmm. One of the infamous but iconic comments made during the Vietnam War was we had to destroy the village to save it. And unfortunately, in Iraq, we seemed to up the ante to we had to destroy the city to save it, and Dexter Filkins' reference to Ramadi in that regard very explicitly.
Dresden.
And it's quite clear that Mr. Filkins has brought a very vivid description to the experience of the soldiers with whom he spent time. But I'm concerned that whereas Americans seem to be disconnected from the war generally, they're greatly more disconnected from the lives of the Iraqis that have been disrupted beyond imagining. And his book would be a great opportunity if he took it to provide such an intimate and visceral sense of what the lives of Iraqis have been like, and I'm wondering if any of that is to be found in it.
Jeff, it's a good question, and I can answer that yes, it's abundantly there, and I'm sorry we couldn't get more of that facet on the air today, but it's a big book in a short time. But Dexter, you hear the thrust of Jeff's question.
Absolutely. Sure. Every day that I was there, you're absolutely right. I was confronted with, the suffering of the Iraqi people, the people who were stuck in the middle of this thing, suffering, in every way and to every degree that you can imagine. I hope I've captured that here. I mean, I've certainly tried.
The questions we're not getting to, and one, Jules Crittenden called in, editor now at the Boston Herald, crossed paths with you in Kashmir years ago. He says, ask how you come out of this looking at Islamic extremism. Huge question. 1 minute to look at it. But what about it, Dexter?
Well, I think that the tricky part is, look, you want to,
kill and capture the crazy guys, right? It's just really, really hard to do. It's just hard to separate him from everybody else. And if you can't do that, then, you know, you're going to make things worse. And so that's, I think that's what, you know, that's what they've been trying to do over the past, you know, 18 months in Iraq is finally to figure out a way to separate the crazies from the great mass of ordinary Iraqis and Afghans who don't want war any more than we do.
You call it the forever war, and it has certainly felt that way. The book's out now. Can you look over the lip of this thing and look beyond it yet? Is the exit in sight somewhere, or is this just, you know, the way it's going to be?
Well, I mean, as to the title, I've been out there for 10 years, and it certainly, while I was there, it felt like forever. And I wanted to convey that, but I think, I mean, to answer your question, these are really, you know, you want to be able to tell everybody we're going to be home next week, but I think it's going to be a long time in both places.
Dexter Filkins, remarkable new book is The Forever War. Dexter, we're glad you survived to write it and very grateful, too, for bringing it to us, reading some of it with us today. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
We'll go out with a concert just this month in Baghdad. Big Noise, performing for American troops in Iraq. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.